Hello, and welcome to Podcast of the Lotus Eaters, episode 694, on the 11th of July, 2023. I am joined by Charlie.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
Fantastic. Good. But bit of housekeeping before we start. A couple of things. If you're a subscriber, which you are, because you're seeing this bit, we've got a lovely episode of Brokenomics coming up at 3 o'clock. It's going to be on the fourth turning, which is very interesting. Also, thank you to Neil, who saw my PO box thing and decided to send in this book, Vancor, which I'm very grateful I don't have a fat tongue when I said that. So thank you very much for sending that in. I've only got this about 5 minutes ago, so I haven't read it yet. And also to Leon, who sent us this 120-year-old book. So appreciate it, guys. Very good. And thank you for joining us, Charlie.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, as always. I just want to say, I knew I was not an economics guy before I started watching Brokenomics. And it's really good stuff, so I'd recommend everybody watch it. If you're not a premium member, go for it, because it's, I mean, if only for that, I mean, alongside all the other stuff, but it's really good.
So one of the reasons we really like Charlie is because he's very honest. So so thank you, Charlie. That was good. Excellent. Right. Oh, yes. Oh, I also need to apologise for the fact that you lovely commenters gave me a hard time for my mic etiquettes last week, so I'm going to be very well behaved this time. Right, should we jump into the first segment, which is going to be all about Holland. So Holland is looking especially stunning and brave right now. So actually, I wanted to do a segment talking about Holland, the fall of the government, and some of the bigger WEF plans going on there. But since the Holland story came up, I couldn't help myself but make reference to this lovely creature, who is the who is now Miss Netherlands.
Yes, Miss Netherlands.
Yes, Miss Netherlands. Now, no, so I have to warn you here, Charlie. We're on a censorship platform, this goes out on.
Indeed.
And we are not allowed to say anything negative about this person, because we were getting a lot of trouble, and they are canning channels left, right and centre for saying anything negative.
So anything negative at all, like even just voicing an aesthetic opinion, let's say.
I wouldn't risk it.
I see.
The way I'm going to get around this one is I think we can still compare the winner to something else and then give our view on the something else.
Yes.
So, but we just can't say anything negative about this lovely lady.
Yeah, value-free analysis.
Yes, exactly. So, speaking of things that I can't say on this platform, I'm gonna plug for something we got on the platform, which is something Mark of the Beast. So, if you're wondering why we're not talking about one of the biggest stories in the world right now, we are. We're just not talking about it on the censorship platform. So, you know, maybe you should head over to the website and check that out. Right. So, yes. So we can't say anything negative about Miss Netherlands. But I decided the way we could get around this is by raiding my wood pile. So here's some wood. So yeah. Miss Netherlands. No. Okay. But what about the runner up? There we go. Wood for the runner up. What else have we got? I think we got Miss Russia. We got that. Oh no! I need to. Yeah, here we go, Miss Russia. I think that's good. That gets a wood.
Not into blondes myself.
Oh really? Oh, okay. Well,
I should say, by the way, I am a taken man, so I feel very, very.
Oh okay. Well,
ashamed
well
of doing
as
this.
Am I. As am I. So we can't go right. And also some completely random Dutch girl that I found on Twitter. There we go. Oh, that's a blonde. Oh, you're going wood for the blonde, right? Yeah. So we can't say anything negative about the winner, who is of course an absolutely lovely lady, but the other ones by comparison we think come out a little bit stronger. Right, so now let's move on to what I actually wanted to talk about, which was the fall of the Dutch government. The Dutch are actually worth paying attention to, I reckon.
Well, they seem to be on the kind of forefront of a lot of this sort of WEF stuff, and we saw obviously the Dutch farmers protest.
Yeah,
you know, it was
that's going to come up. Yeah,
yeah, no doubt. But you know, it seems they are something of a model for you know, other countries going forward.
Well, I was thinking even broader than that, because I mean, of course, America's the big cheese at the moment, and China's about to be the big cheese, and before that, the British were the big cheese. But before the British, it was actually the Dutch.
Of course.
So yeah. I mean, they are kind of a big thing. I mean, they've maybe not kept up quite the relevance in the recent years. But you know, they are worth paying attention to. And actually, the thing that I want to start this story on, because I'm going to weave a bit before I get to the collapse of the government, because I think there's a couple of things that lead into it. I'm going to start with this, which is the McKinsey and Company report into smart cities. Now, is that something you've encountered, smart cities?
I've heard of the concept. And yes. I mean, immediately I'm sceptical. So, I mean, everything is smart.
Well, it's different from the 15-minute cities, because the 15-minute cities are basically taking the existing cities and then just, you know, making it so you can't leave. But these smart cities are something else. They're, well, I'll read from the McKinsey report so we get an idea what it is about. So this is from the report. Smart cities is also about using technology and data purposefully to make better decisions and deliver a better quality of life. It finds that cities can use smart technology to improve some key quality of life indicators by 10 to 30%. Numbers that translate into lives saved, fewer crime incidents, shorter commutes and a reduced health burden, and carbon emissions averted. Establishing channels for two-way communication between the public and local agencies could make city governments more responsive. We're getting into the dubious bit now. Many cities' agencies maintain an active presence on social networks, and others develop their own interactive citizen apps. So basically, it's pitching total surveillance and a social credit system.
It sounds like literally the apotheosis of like spreadsheet managerialism.
Yes. You know? Yes, it's people who manage everything and then thought, okay, how can we manage these bloody people that we've got running around all over the place?
Well, that's the thing, you know, smart always seems to be a euphemism for literally just
control
everything. You know, like, I mean, it seems maybe like a more trivial example, but smart motorways, for example, that we have in this country, where it's just, you know, the attempt to manage every single little detail in the name of efficiency, but it actually ends up causing more problems than it solves.
Yeah, those smart motorways are terrifying because there's no hard shoulder.
Yeah, I know. So it's led to many deaths.
So if you get a blown tyre, and I very almost had a blown tyre just a week ago, if I had family in the car, you'd just be sat there with a lorry coming up behind you.
Yeah.
Nothing you can do, so terrifying. And actually, another thing about smart things is smart meters. I think in Texas recently, the energy companies increased, because it was aircon that they were running at the time, so they increased the thermostats in the homes of thousands of homes because they had an energy shortage without telling the homeowners about it. This is essentially what smart means. It's handing over control. I'll read the next bit of the McKinsey report, because this bit is unintentionally based. In a high-crime city with a population of 5 million, this could mean saving 300 lives a year. Incidents of assault, robbery, burglary and auto theft could be lowered by 30 to 40%. On top of these metrics, the incalculable benefits of giving residents freedom of movement and peace of mind. Well, freedom from freedom, essentially. Technology is not a quick fix for crime, but agencies can use data to deploy scarce resources and personnel more effectively. Real-time crime mapping, for instance, utilising statistic and analysis to highlight patterns. Pattern recognition is not normally what you're allowed to do in crime.
Problematic.
Yes. While predictive policing goes a step further, anticipating crime to head off incidents before they occur. So, you know, bit Minority Report there.
Yeah.
And this bit, I might have lifted this bit from a different section of the report, but I think it fits in quite neatly here. Cities can use data and analytics to identify demographic groups with elevated risk profiles and target interventions more precisely.
Wow.
Yeah. So, unintentionally based, I'm sure.
We have to wonder if it will be, if the systems in question will be fiddled with, as with the, you know, the AI systems that we see coming up now, where the coders or whatever.
Yes.
They put their own biases into it to balance out the biases that reality seems to have.
Yes.
If you see what I'm saying.
Yes. Yeah. Well, my biggest concern with this is, okay, so they're putting on all of these methods to basically to head down a crime problem. But why don't we just not start taking these homogeneous low crime cultures and then ramming immigration into them until they end up like France?
That's a great idea.
Yes.
Yeah, brilliant idea.
Clever thought, isn't it? But no, they don't want to do that. So instead, they've come along with this smart cities thing. So you're just thinking, okay, well, it's a WEF plan, and I'm not going to show you the WEF document, but I'll stick it in the reading link so you can just find that. The EU have adopted it. I will show you the EU document. So here we go. Oh, I might need to... can we scroll down to the bit below? Right, yeah, go into that bit. Right, now scroll down in that bit, and it'll give you a little map. Here we go. Right, so that's the plan for smart city rollout that has been agreed between the WEF and the EU. Now, thankfully, Britain isn't mentioned on that.
Grayed out there.
Yes, I guess we're... Well, I suppose we're not in the EU, so that would be why. But you'll notice that the Netherlands features quite heavily for quite a small country.
Yes, yes.
So what's going on with them is they've decided to take this thing one step further. They're not gonna just have a smart city. They're going to have this massive tri-state city thing.
Oh, Jesus.
Let's go to the next document for that. So this is from the Dutch government. There we go. Oh, it scrolls past, but it was on the bit that I wanted, but that's fine. It will come back around again. So we got this document here from, the massive tri-state city that they're looking to come in. Any second now, we'll scroll back to the bit. Yeah, you sort of see it there. And massive sort of countrywide...
This one
here. We go. That sort of city Look thing that it's doing. So now you might be thinking to yourself, well, the only problem with that... is that Holland is basically the biggest agricultural producer or exporter in the world.
One of, yeah, certainly.
It's massive. Yeah. So there's lots of farms in the way of this fantastic project. But they put our mind at ease. If we scroll to the bottom of this webpage, just go straight to the bottom. There it goes. It reassures us. This model has no relationship with the nitrogen policy of the Dutch government.
So, that's very reassuring.
Yes, very reassuring. Mm. So you might be thinking, okay, well, what is... the nitrogen policy of the Dutch government, right? Well, you know how basically in the US and UK and various other countries, the logic basically goes something like this: it is carbon dioxide, reasons, therefore communism.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yep.
Now the Dutch have obviously looked at this and thought, well, that's not going to work because carbon is like 0.04% of the
atmosphere.
Yeah. Yes, we got a chart. Yes, yeah. So so carbon dioxide is a tiny amount of the atmosphere. So that's not going to be scary. Mm. How can we scare people? Look at the big blue bit. Nitrogen, 78% of the atmosphere. That's what we're going to terrify people with. So the Dutch version is ever so clever. It is basically nitrogen, reasons. Therefore, communism.
Mm. Inventive. Yes. You've got to give them
yes.
that.
Yes, I quite like that.
Yeah.
So basically, what the Dutch have done is they've come up with this clever plan where they're going to forcibly acquire 3,000 family farms and liquidate them,
destroy
them. Now that is something that really annoys me because Europe does this a lot, and I always explain this that the base tier of an economy is energy and agriculture.
Yeah.
Everything beyond that point, you can swap around as much as you want.
Mm.
You know, if you're making a lot of washing machines and nobody wants washing machines, you just make, you know, hi-fis instead. Mm. Whatever. Basically, everything after that. But energy and agriculture are absolute base tier.
Yeah.
And those are the two things that Western, especially European governments, seem absolutely determined to demolish as fast as they possibly can.
Well, I mean, you only need to think about it for 10 seconds for that to make sense. I mean, if there's no food, there's no civilization, yes, there's no order. Well,
yes.
Yeah, you're just
and energy, of course. I mean, that's why we're doing this as opposed to being subsistence farmers.
Of course,
is because of the energy that gets you the returns. I mean, that's even more base tier than agriculture.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, Western, especially European governments, are incredibly hostile to farming. So they have basically been, putting into plan their attempts to try and forcibly acquire these homes. The farmers who live there, of course, they're not particularly happy with this whole situation. So it leads to situations like this, where the Dutch police end up shooting at Dutch children. And in this one case, it was a 16-year-old farmer boy in a tractor driving away from police, and the police decided to open fire on him. Let's watch this.
Kian Bexy here with the counter signal. After driving across the Netherlands from blockade to blockade, I ended up with a convoy that was making its way across the southern end of the country so that they could blockade an undisclosed location. Now, they've just pulled over and they've stopped after some news came through the grapevine that the police actually started opening fire on their fellow protesters just north of this location.
Neil, hey, wapens, jongen, wapens.
Driving away from the police.
It's pretty scary stuff. Now, this prime minister, this leftist globalist prime minister, will stop at nothing to silence any dissidents.
I think we've got one bit that comes straight after this. Can we go into the next bit? Do we have that? Oh, no, we don't. Okay, so there was a slight addendum, but I don't think I described it properly in my notes. But basically, then it speaks to a Dutch farmer who describes that this sort of police action is not historically normal for the Netherlands, but over the last 2 years the police have become extremely aggressive towards the Dutch people. Now, we saw this, of course, very heavily in the sort of the lockdown civil wars the government's committed against their people over the last couple of years. Holland was like the Australia of Europe.
Right, is that right?
It was quite, distressing watching some of the sort of the graphic images coming out of that. And I you would see loads of videos of basically peaceful protesters saying, we should be able to go outside and see our loved ones.
Far right,
and
presumably.
Freely associate and stuff like that. Yeah. And the police would basically attack them. I mean, just blatantly attack them, just pull truncheons.
Yeah.
And charge straight at them and start clubbing them. And I think I'm right in saying it was Holland that got to the point where the aged veterans would come out in their uniforms and their medals and stand between the police and the protesters, because at least even the cowardly scum Dutch police recognised that bludgeoning aged veterans,
it's not a great look.
Was bad optics. Yeah. So they managed to pull short of that.
I mean, I'm not sure if the Netherlands had any problems with the, shall we say, regime approved protest movements, burning down cities and so on.
I don't know if they did actually. Yeah. Yeah.
I've never heard anything about it. I mean, it would be very weird for that to happen in the Netherlands. Of all
places. Yeah, I mean, it'd be weird for it happened anywhere.
I mean, obviously we have to wonder whether the police would be as aggressive with those sorts of characters, friends of the regime, as opposed to enemies like this.
I would imagine not. Yeah, if we've got any Dutch viewers, do let us know in the comments if you had the Summer of Floyd in Holland as well. That would be interesting to know. But it wasn't just people trying to defend their farms and homes from police aggression on the streets. There was also a political pushback. Mm. And that came in the form of, bear with me while I say this, Boer Burger Beweging Party, commonly abbreviated to BBB for obvious reasons, but we can just call it the Farmers Party. Mm. So now, for some reason, and this confuses me, and again, you know, maybe Dutch commenters can explain this to me. For some reason, Dutch democracy does not seem to be quite as well fortified as it is in most other places and most other WEF partners.
Mm.
So
seems a very dangerous threat to democracy.
Yes.
Yeah,
precisely. Yeah. Because this happened.
Unbridled joy for Caroline van der Plas as her party shook up the Dutch political landscape on Wednesday evening. Founded just 4 years ago, the BBB is now projected to be the largest party in the Senate.
This could mean we will be the biggest party in the Netherlands. This isn't normal, not normal. Well, actually, I do find it normal, but I never expected it.
The elections that took place were provincial, but they also indirectly decide the makeup of the country's National Senate. The BBB, or Farmer Citizen Movement, is projected to be the largest party in the Senate, with 15 out of 75 seats. The same amount as the Labour Party and Dutch Green Party coalition. Prime Minister Mark Rutte's party, VVD, is predicted to go down from 12 to 10 seats. And according to van der Plas, this will make the governing coalition take her party seriously.
What does this mean for the coalition in the Senate? They already had a small majority, but now it's reduced.
Oh, no, there's more. Yeah, well, whatever. Anyway, so where, I think where that clip was getting to was the Farmers' Party became the largest party. And I think it had more than the ruling coalition, which was a coalition of two parties. Obviously, that wasn't going to be viable. So Mark Rutte, the globalist on the bicycle that we saw slightly earlier, he had to come back to this. And his response was to spend 10 months forming a new coalition. And that new coalition was a fragile four-party coalition of the People's Party for Freedom and Democracy, which was his party, which is probably the most inappropriately named political party
certainly
of some time.
Yeah, yes.
So I might as well start calling myself a skinny black woman. the Liberal Democrats Democrat Party, the Christian Democratic Appeal Party, and the centrist ChristiUnie Party, which sounds like a feminine hygiene product.
So they
got put together. That lasted 18 months and then collapsed messily last Friday. Let's watch from our based friends in Australia describing this.
Well, it's turmoil in the Netherlands right now, with Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte resigning after his government collapsed in a row over immigration. This shake-up has paved the way for a general election later in the year, with a substantial possibility that the populist pro-farmer BBB party could claim power. Wouldn't that be extraordinary? Joining us now to discuss this is our great friend from the Netherlands, Ralph Schulhammer. Ralph, great to see you again. Always good to have you on the show, and thank you for staying up so late to chat to us. What is happening in Holland, mate? What's going on?
Well, we live in absurd times, right? Ben and Jerry's wants to give back lands. The Dutch government wants to take land. Nobody knows who owns what anymore. Nobody gave a great introduction. If the government did implode, the main reason was the asylum politics, which is quite interesting, because apparently Mark Rutte, who is the longest serving head of government in Europe, together with Viktor Orban, so he has been around for 13 years, apparently now has discovered his inner hardliner when it comes to migration.
So apparently the story is that they collapsed due to a row over immigration.
Mm.
The version is that that globalist guy was trying to pretend that he was more hawkish on immigration, although that might have been pre-positioning because he realised that his coalition was unstable and he was getting attacks from the right, and therefore his positioning as much as anything.
Yeah.
That guy then goes on to speculate that he might even try and form a coalition with the Farmers' Party. But I think we heard earlier today that he's given up on that notion. He's decided to pull out of politics.
Mm.
So very encouraging.
That's a victory, and we have to take that.
Yeah, that's great. Is a victory. Yeah. So you know, well done to the Dutch. Have you ever been to Holland?
I haven't. No, I haven't.
Right,
I'd like to go.
I went once, years and years. It must have been 20 years ago now. But I was in the office, and it was like a Thursday afternoon, and I said to our guys, "Oh, I'll see you tomorrow," and they said, "Oh no, it's a 4-day weekend." Because it's like the Easter weekend. So I thought, oh, okay, well, what am I going to do with myself? So I went on the interweb that we had back then.
Yeah.
And there was a site called lastminute.com.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I managed to find there was a train leaving from Paddington in about half an hour that would go down to some catamaran thing and then get me over to Amsterdam for the 4 days and then bring me back again. So I thought, oh, I'll do that. So I grabbed a gym bag from under the desk, didn't bother getting change or anything, and just sort of ran to the station and did that. I got to Amsterdam, and then I discovered there must have been something going on because every single hotel was booked.
Oh my God!
Like every single one. So I spent about 4 or 5 hours trying to find a hotel. Couldn't find one. It was really bloody cold. It was almost on the verge of snowing. So I didn't know what to do. So then I had the bright idea. Well, I know what I do. I'll go to a nightclub and I'll find a local who can put me up for the night. But the only problem with that is normally I would fancy my chances there, but women could smell desperation, right?
Yeah,
and it was really bloody cold, so I would have been. I mean, I would have taken a 6.5 at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe even a 6.2 because I hadn't crossed a Dutch off my list at this stage. But it didn't matter because I managed. By the time I managed to find a club, they were basically throwing out at that point.
Oh no!
So I couldn't get that. So I loitered around for a while and thought I'd try and catch somebody's eye, and it sort of worked because there was one lass who came out and gave me a smile and then stopped down the street a little bit and had a cigarette and kept on looking back. And you might think that's good, but she was like mid to late 30s, so I carried on up the street. Right, and what I had to do in the end is I found a massive pile of chairs and tables outside a cafe with a big tarpaulin over. And then I went to one of those hole-in-the-wall kiosk newsagents type things, and I bought his entire box of cigarette lighters and bummed an elastic band off him and then made myself a little jerry-rigged gas heater and just sat under that while it snowed all night.
It's weirdly romantic in a way.
Well, it was just me, so it wasn't that good. And then when I heard the tarpauling being taken off in the morning, I just had to sort of stand up and...
Yeah.
Give them a good smile.
Thanks, lads.
Yes, march off down the street purposefully with my sports bag over my shoulder, leaving them to wonder why there's a little replica stone hinge made out of used lighters at the bottom of their pile of tables and chairs. But you do these things when you're in your 20s, don't you? So,
of course, yes.
Yeah, so random sidetrack. But anyway, well done, Holland. Good to see you fighting back against the globalists. And if you keep this back, I will come back for a second time and I will book a hotel this time. Right,
so... I'm going to talk about a very special event that has happened in London over the last week. And I'm hoping that this segment, like yours actually, is going to be a bit of a white pill. Very positive podcast today, isn't it?
Yeah.
So this is an art exhibition called quite simply The Exhibition. And this took place, as I said, in London over the last week. And I just want to read out their mission.
So it's closed now, isn't it? So we can't...
It has closed now, but there are... Well, this was a proof of concept, this event, because they are intending to do many, many more of these in the future.
Yes.
But what this was, look, we can do this. We can bring all these very interesting, very talented people together, and we can put on, a successful show, if you want. So the mission statement of this event is as follows. So we come together because we are hungry for true beauty, aesthetic strength, and vital expressions. Because we want to see culture that energizes. Because we have been standing on the sidelines watching how the flame of true creation has been smothered by petty ideology. This is a momentous occasion. Like-minded artists from across Europe joining forces to make a cultural shift. We believe this is a pivotal moment in its nascent stage. Inspired by the collectives that have formed before us, we stand unapologetically to carve out another route in this time of artistic stagnation. If we don't rekindle this fire, who will? And I've got to say, I went to this. I was invited by Ferro, who was one of the artists there who viewers may be familiar with, if you know, in these circles. It completely succeeds in that mission, for one thing, because I mean, I've never experienced anything quite like it before. So you know, the room was brimming with sort of you know, as Jonathan Bowden might say, fire, energy, glory, and thinking. That's a great quote that I like.
Okay. Do you have examples?
Yes. We're going to go through. There's the poster there. So you've got the artist there. So you've got Matthew the Stoat, Alexander Adams, who is a friend of the show and has been on before. Harold Markram, Vladan Pijanovic, I think that's how you pronounce his name. Fender Villiers, Sam Wild, and Columba and Ferro.
Some of those.
Yeah. John, if we can go on to the video. So this was the exhibition. So this is a kind of virtual tour, and we're gonna have this run in the background while I speak, because it's quite a long.
Whereabouts in London was this?
I can't actually remember the nearest tube station was Warren Street. It was a place called the Fitzrovia. Sorry, good. Say again, John. It was the Fitzrovia Gallery, as you can see, it's just a great location. I'm no art critic, but I mean, yeah. Some of the art on display was, all of the art on display was phenomenal. This was some of Ferro's work here, and Alexander Adams just above. You know, you can tell really, really great
stuff. It's got a much more sort of heroic theme to it than the sort of...
Well, that's the thing. You know, it's all very, again, it's all energy, it's all power, and it's all strength. And yes. Fundamentally, you know, I've been to you know, many art galleries in my time, and somewhere like the National Gallery, for example.
Yes.
Obviously, the art there is beautiful and stunning and fantastic.
Well, but
The
old stuff.
Old stuff, yeah.
Yes, the old stuff is good.
Yeah.
Our culture was once good.
Of course, but, yes. You know, my sense is that it's from a time that's dead. It's from a world that is long gone. And I don't, you know, I feel that kind of sentimental attachment to the art that you find somewhere like the National Gallery.
I've been to things like the Tate Modern, that's rubbish.
Well, I'm going to get onto that in a moment, actually. Okay. But this, I mean, the sense in this room, it was very much alive. You know, again, the energy there was just palpable. It was electric. And the enthusiasm and passion of the artists there, I mean, again, you could feel it. I spoke to several of them, and I was, you know, taken round, and the artist spoke to me about their art, and it was just, you know, so good. I mean, this Fender Villiers sculpture work here is just so good. I think this is called Prometheus, this piece, and again, you can just see, you know, the power, the energy.
Everything's got a lot more sort of like I say, heroic energy, sense of will, sense of purpose, because normally I look at contemporary art and I just don't like it at all.
But yeah.
Everything I've seen so far is something that I would actually buy.
Mm, yeah. Well, you still can. If you go onto the exhibition website, you can still buy some of the pieces.
I'll say which bits I like best then.
Yes. No, indeed. It was all great. And, you know, there were quite a few different styles on display. Again, I'm no art critic, so I can't use the proper terminology.
No, I'm not. But all the same, I know if I see something and I like it.
Yes.
And like I said, this has got the sort of heroic will type energy.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, really, really powerful stuff. You brought up the Tate Modern. I want to contrast this with somewhere like that, because to me, yeah, I've been to the Tate Modern many times, and there was a time where when I was younger, where I thought it was kind of cool because everybody said it was cool. But actually, now that I've become a bit more aware of what somewhere like the Tate Modern represents, I regard it as this kind of cathedral to anti, sort of regime approved anti art.
So is this meant to be right wing art?
Well, this is the thing. It wasn't a necessarily explicitly political event. I think it's deeper than politics, frankly. It is a collective of dissident people. You know, Ferro, Columba, and so on go on AA's channel.
Because I'm seeing lots of swords, dragons being slain,
yes.
Angels, swords.
Yeah. I mean, it champions strength and power. It doesn't champion, for instance, you know, minority concerns, let's say.
I've seen a lot of contemporary street art, and a lot of the time it's just like completely nondescript fat black women.
Well, it's just surface level, you know, politics of the day type stuff. Yes. Whereas this is a far deeper. I mean, you know, I'm going to go on to talk about an article, but this is the birth of a movement. That's really what it felt like.
Oh, I see.
Really fantastic stuff. But again, to contrast it with somewhere like the Tate Modern, which is, I mean, even the architecture of the place. John, if we could move on to just to remind viewers of what the Tate Modern looks like from the outside.
seem to remember it's fairly not. Oh yes,
there we go. Just this horrible imposition on you.
Yes, it does look like a sort of Soviet building that you get taken to and never come out of.
Yeah, well, it's a post-war building, and it's very much in that tradition, if you could even dare call it that. Yeah. But it's just totally the opposite of this. Well, you know, this is. And the interesting thing about the somewhere like the Tate Modern, and actually the left wing more generally, a lot of them still think that they are the scrappy dissidents, you know, the rebel type force in society.
Yes.
Whereas obviously we all recognise that that's complete nonsense.
They absolutely control everything.
Yeah. Whereas when I was at this, I really did feel like these were people, for one thing, who were all of a like mind, which was really refreshing, and all who recognised that we, frankly, we are the kind of, the you know, the rebel force, the scrappy, you know, characters. That was one of Farrow's pieces that I really liked. That it was a
lion with wings. What do you call that? A lion with wings or whatever. It's a mythological creature of some sort.
But that was great because I mean, I don't want to talk about his art as if I know all about it, but he explained it to me that it was a representation of England, you know, the three lions. And you know, the first is the former glory, second is the current emaciated,
hunting,
weakened
images,
state. Yeah.
Stuff. Yeah.
And the third was the kind of revitalizing figure. And that, again, that was really just the sense throughout the whole event. It was just this sense of rebirth, you know.
There's a lot of inspiration from sort of British mythology that is coming through.
Yes.
A whole bunch of this stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's very, very, very British for one thing, but very Western in general.
Yeah.
Which is refreshing.
So I did actually go to the Tate Modern once and had a look around. And again, it was years and years ago, but it was when Tracy Emin's bed.
Oh, yeah.
You remember
yeah.
that was on display. Mm. And I mean, it was kind of interesting in a sense because that was being talked about in the media all the time.
Yeah.
And it basically just said it was this messy bed and it was basically sort of left at that. So I made myself go along and basically stare at it until I could see what was happening.
Yeah.
And it was kind of this messy bed on one side. And you had sort of pizza boxes and underwear and used contraception and all that kind of stuff sprued on one side of the bed.
Yeah.
And then on the other side of the bed was this, and the newspapers never mentioned this, was this locked suitcase, like with chains and stuff around it and padlocks. Okay. And presumably it was supposed to talk about some aspect of the discomfort of modern femininity, which was being forced to be this sort of garish, one night stand seeking, junk food eating woman.
Yeah.
And it was completely at odds with that inner sense of herself, which was presumably meant to be represented by the padlocked briefcase on the suitcase on the other side with the chains around it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I never knew that.
It was at odds with this lifestyle that she thought that she had to live. But I mean, that ended up for me being a sort of an analogy for the whole of the sort of left-wing experience, which is to debase yourself, to live only in the moment, to seek the hedonistic pleasures, and then be at war with your own sense of self, which you've had to lock away in order to get through this.
And you always know, you know, deep down, there's always a even unconscious awareness of contradiction.
It's making women, and men in these days, live against a way which goes against their most fundamental nature.
Well, and again, you contrast that with somewhere like this, where it is all, you know, it's again, nature was, you could feel that here. It was
what I take from this is that art was about frivolity and casualness and sluttery and all the rest of it. Everything I've seen here, it imbues a sense of struggle. So the centerpiece for people who are listening is this guy it looks like he's either trying to climb something or he's forcing himself against a heavy wind. But basically there was a sense of struggle and he's having to do something or go somewhere or achieve something. And it's not easy. And he's really having to put his back into it. That's the centerpiece.
But it's a heroic image.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's really good. And then the rest of the stuff as you go round, again, I'm seeing constantly senses of image achievement of conquering something, hunting images at the back. It's all about, you know, we've got to do something and it's not easy, which contrasts with, you know, the example that I've seen at the Tate Modern, which was, you know, let's just give in to our most base instincts at the most immediate time frame.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, to think about the values represented, again, you know, Tracy Emin's Unmade Bed, I haven't looked at it for a long time, but again, it does kind of champion this this hedonistic you know, messiness, whereas there's a level of seriousness that the, you know, the art of the exhibition had that just, you know, modern art doesn't possess. But anyway, I'd like to move on to the politics. And one last thing, you know, we could say that the art of the Tate Modern is what Alexander Adams, who is one of the artists at the exhibition, would call artivism.
He's a good bloke, actually.
Yeah, he's very good. So, you know, Carl and him spoke about his book, Artivism, on a book club some time ago. And, I mean, again, you go there and the sense is that this is a deeply, I don't quite know how to put it. But the art on display is not there because it's beautiful. It's there because of the message, capital TM. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, that's worth getting. It's worth listening to.
Yeah, it's a very good episode.
To Alexander, because, I mean, obviously, we are not art people.
So
we're trying to bumble our way through this. But but Alex is a proper art person. So it's something you're going to want to know something about. So yeah, it's well worth checking that out.
Yeah. But anyway, I'd like to move on to just talking about, because we have to, talking about the politics of this event, what it actually represents. Okay. Because, you know, again, as a proof of concept, it's just phenomenal. Getting all of these people together in a room together at once. You know, it's a great achievement in and of itself. And, you know, like I spend quite a lot of time in like Westminster and media circles and this sort of thing.
Yes.
And it was so refreshing to be among people that are actually of like mind, people who actually are serious about, you know, change and opposition to the current order. Actually, I spoke to Columba for quite some time, and he said something to the effect of, like, it's just so nice not having to explain. Like, when you're talking to someone, you have the same, you know, the same level of understanding about this stuff, so you can just go straight in and have quite a high level
conversation. Yeah, that was something that I really enjoyed. Well, it's hard to say I enjoyed anything about it, but the lockdown civil war that our government's committed against us, I mean, what it did make us do is then go along to all these protests.
Yes.
And again, it was just wonderful being amongst people who exactly that. You don't need to explain yourself.
Yeah.
You don't need to apologise. I don't apologise anyway. But you often find yourself having to pick your words to navigate your way through something without causing a big re on the other side of it. So that's the big problem with our modern age is it has allowed us to reach out to all sorts of people who share our views.
Yeah.
But often they're like miles away on the other side of the world or something like that.
Yeah.
And we've got to start coming back to face to face.
Yeah, yeah, I couldn't agree more. So there's a very good article that's come out on Bournebrook by SD Wickett that I want to draw attention to about the exhibition, because it's a very good article and it really sums up the kind of atmosphere there really well. And there's one quote in particular that I just want to read out in the spirit of what we were just talking about. So he recalls this legend that goes as follows. So he says, in 1976, the Sex Pistols played a show at the Lesser Free Trade Hall in Manchester. There was, figuratively, no one there. However, every one of these nobodies became a somebody. Ian Curtis and the future members of Joy Division were supposedly there, as were Morrissey and Johnny Marr. Mick Hucknall of Simply Red, Mark E. Smith of the Fall. It was put on by the Buzzcocks, and some even say that Bono was there. Most of these supposed attendees were, in fact, elsewhere on that night, but the moral of the legend is the same. In the trajectory of an artistic movement, it is not a question of how many are in the room, but rather who is in the room, and that's fundamental right there. That story and the surrounding legend was clear in my mind as I left the Fitzrovia Gallery in London, having witnessed what I knew to be the birth of a new aesthetic movement within the British right, one that is vital, distinct, cool, and forward-facing, while not abandoning the past, but taking it along for the ride. And I mean, I couldn't agree more with that analysis. And what he said there about who was in the room, I think that's really fundamental to understand. Because we talk about, I mean, in these circles, we talk about the primacy of organisation and, you know, how you know, mere numbers doesn't actually yield any change. You know, that we need to be, it needs to be people of quality and not mere quantity.
Yes.
And the sense at this place was, for one thing, the sort of average age was fairly low, which I found, you know, quite encouraging. Mm. And the caliber of person there was very, very high.
Mm.
So I came away feeling the exact same. I came away feeling optimistic, energized, you know, just really positive, frankly. You know, as I said, it's the mission statement that they laid out at the start completely succeeded in that. It was just fantastic. So yeah, I mean, again, as a proof of concept, it's wonderful that this went ahead.
Great example. I mean, I'd like to see more examples of people, I mean, networking and meeting up. You just find an excuse.
Yeah,
for some reason.
Absolutely.
But make real connections, because something is coming.
Mm.
And, you know, if at the end of the day, you can't survive on digital friends alone.
Mm. Yeah, but again, to think about this as mere politics is wrong, because it's so much more than that.
Yeah.
It's so much deeper than that, and that's what's important to remember. And in that spirit, I do want to just conclude with a kind of a sentiment that I was very aware of and that I spoke to quite a few people about while I was there. And I'm actually going to cite Douglas Murray, of all people, to communicate that. So this is from The Madness of Crowds. He says, "Of all the ways in which people can find meaning in their lives, politics is one of the unhappiest. Politics may be an important aspect of our lives, but as a source of personal meaning, it is disastrous. Not just because the ambitions it strives after nearly always go unachieved, but because finding purpose in politics laces politics with a passion, including a rage, that perverts the whole enterprise." And I mean, when I read that initially, I thought that was really true. Now, I don't necessarily have a problem with passion in politics. I think it's very important, especially on our side of things. But I think that he is very, I mean, you know, he's correct in saying that finding your purpose, you know, trying to find meaning in politics is basically a fool's endeavor. And I've been fallen for this, made politics my whole life, and it does kind of drive you mad. It makes you a little
politics
bit weird.
Politics in the news cycle sucks you in.
Yeah,
but it doesn't give you any substance.
No, it doesn't. And so, again, the kind of the substance of life, the nourishing, that was the word that I came away thinking of, nourishing, nourishing substance, is to be found in things like this. It's to be found in our culture, our history. We have to remember what we're fighting for, if you want. And I think events like this are essential for that reason. You know, they really do remind us of what's actually important. Because we can talk politics all day, we can talk strategy all day, and so on, and that is important. But if we don't do anything else other than that, well, what's actually the point of our movement?
But fundamentally, underlying things such as family and culture do matter more.
Absolutely, yeah. So politics is all well and good, but we have to have something to fight for. And this is, the exhibition is a great achievement, and I cannot wait to see where we go in the future.
There we go. Definitely look to check out the one next year. So. So that's really encouraging. That's really nice. We've had two white pill segments.
Yes.
Really uplifting. That's wonderful. So now I'm going to do a segment on how it's all going to shit completely.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, just to bring down the tone. I mean, people like that. So, let's talk about US house prices and the state of things over there. So, don't know if you remember, but about a month ago, Callum and I did a segment on the US debt ceiling deal. Mm. I mean, that wasn't that long ago now. In fact, when was it? It was the 5th of June. 5th of June. The new debt ceiling got agreed and I did that video. Yeah. Back then, the debt was $31.5 trillion. It had taken the US government 247 years to get to $31.5 trillion. So how long do you reckon it took them to add an extra trillion on top of that? Well, we're already there. Let's have a look at this. This is a table of US debt spaced out every couple of days since last month, and look, there we go, from 31.5 trillion to 32.5 trillion, an increase of a trillion in a month.
That is astonishing.
It's going completely mad at this point.
I mean, again, if you watch Brokenomics, you will understand why this is so disastrous.
it is monstrously disastrous at this. Right, so and look, that's just the US government debt pile. It's not including state debt, it's not including private debt, it's not including the debt that they are legally obligated to take on board. Because if you were to add in, you know, all the Medicare and the state debt and the private debt, I mean, you'd be in the hundreds of trillions of debt at this point. So basically that is just the US's credit card.
Right.
So then you might ask yourself, okay, well, what is the US paying out on its credit card? Well, let's go to the next one. So this is how much the federal government is having to spend on just its current debt pile. So effectively, its credit card bill every month to maintain minimum payments. And as you can see, it's very nearly going to hit $1 trillion.
A month?
No, a year.
A year, sorry.
A trillion dollars a year just to pay interest on the debt, which is not good, especially when you bear in mind that actually it's spending $1 trillion, and that's out of $6 trillion. Its total spending is $6 trillion.
Yeah.
So it's a monstrous amount. And what's even worse is they only collect 4.7 in taxes.
Yeah, this is disastrous.
Yeah,
this is like a tailspin. It's
proper debt spiral stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I like, people aren't, for whatever reason, quite as interested in these segments. But I mean, it really matters, because I'm sure if people were told, you know, before the 2008 crisis and all the other financial crises, by the way, this is coming and it's coming at you really fast. Yeah. They'd want to know. But for some reason, people tend to prefer hearing about it after it's happened before, as opposed to before it's happened.
Well, it's all quite abstract, isn't it? Because I mean, we're looking at a graph here. And I mean, we can recognize this looks really, really bad. But until it becomes flesh, until it is made real, I think it's quite hard for to actually wrap your head around.
Well, that's why I tend to break it down by individuals. So if you are a US taxpayer, then the government is spending $48,000 for every one of you.
Excellent.
Right? And it's spending $8,000 per taxpayer just on servicing the debt. Mm. So if you're a US taxpayer listening to this, the government is spending $48,000 of your money every year. Now, I don't know how many of you are actually paying $48,000 a year in tax. You know, fortunately, taxes are disproportionately skewed towards the people who earn more. Mm. So you know, there's a few presumably NBA players and Hollywood types in there who are sort of paying a little bit more. But that is a monstrous amount of money that the US taxpayers are being required to cough up on this stuff.
Yeah. Think of all the things you could buy with $48,000.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But the fundamental problem is they're spending, They're spending, 6.2 and they're collecting 4.7.
Yeah.
So it's easy to see why where all the debt is coming from on this. So, yeah. So you take the magic money tree of all the money that they printed to try and make the numbers add up. You add on all of the debt that's coming out. And you've got to ask yourself, you know, are there any negative downstream effects of the magic money tree and the debt print and the debt generation?
I wonder.
Well, funnily enough, yes, there is. So all the time that this has been going on, of course, we've had that massive inflation effect that's come true. I've decided to make this mainly about the US, or I could do this about the UK as well. But it's got so bad inflation in the UK that the Times reported recently the UK government is thinking of kiboshing any and all pay rises in the public sector.
Really?
Because they're worried that inflation is going to get out of control if they allow any more pay rises. Now, that's not actually how inflation works because the inflation is there because of the money that's already been printed.
Yeah.
What they're really trying to do is they're trying to lower everybody's living standards to try and make the sums add up again, to try and get rid of the deficit, to basically control the wage bill, making everybody effectively poorer while they sort of get away with devaluing the money by printing lots of it.
It's probably also worth mentioning very quickly that, I mean, we have a lot of strikes in this country at the moment. I've literally, in the last week, been affected by this because my dissertation for my university degree hasn't been marked as a result of the strikes. And that's the case for many, many other people across the country. And again, they're sort of, you know, the strikes are because these public sector, this is nurses, doctors, tube drivers and so on.
Yeah, I'm really glad I'm not in London anymore because it must be a right pain.
Yeah, nightmare.
At least London isn't on fire like Paris.
Well, indeed. Yeah, well, that's small mercies.
I mean, this week.
But, you know, the junior doctors, for instance, are asking for a 35% pay increase. So if the government are saying they're going to, you know, halt all pay increases, again, it's just everything is just kind of collapsing in on itself, isn't it?
Yeah, and what's going to happen there is the doctors are then going to just leave and stop go to Australia or something else. Yeah, or get a job in McDonald's.
Yeah. And presumably the solution to that will be, you guessed it, more mass immigration.
Yes, exactly.
Brilliant.
Which is then going to require more debt printing to integrate and all the rest of it comes with it. So, yeah, so as a result of all of this, basically they've been having to generate the debt and the money printing, which leads to massive inflation. Mm. And then to try and counter that, they've been doing the interest rates. So we've got the next chart. So this is US government bond yield. So basically interest rates going back to the early 90s there. And basically what's happening is as government has been growing, they have been having to lower the cost of money in order to make the sums add up. That's essentially what you're seeing there with that line going down. You know, cost of money going down until effectively money became free. Mm. That was the only way that they could make the sums add up anymore was making money free if you are a government or large corporate entity. And then because of the inflation that was generated, they then ended up having to whack these rates up. And that's what's really undoing everything is the, we've saw there the fastest ever increase of rates. Mm. Which is breaking everything. I mean, it's breaking the corporate property sector.
Yeah.
It's breaking the banks because they are basically having to borrow money at 5%, and then their loan book is paying like 3.8%. it just doesn't work. It'd be like a greengrocer who bought bananas for 50p and sold them for 38p. Mm. It just doesn't add up.
It's probably, I mean, again, I'm no economist, so you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but it's probably worth noting that that's at the same level as 2008, right? Is that relevant? Just based on the fact that 2008 was a big...
Well, I mean, it's even worse because we were used to relatively higher rates, and so the existing stock of debt, everybody had built their assumptions on a higher cost of debt.
I see, right.
And therefore, that had a knock-on price to assets, as we see in the next example with houses. Because when you get people used to 0%, and then you throw them up to 5%, that's a hell of a lot worse than people being used to, say, 2.5% and going to 5.
Sure, yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, it's still bad, but it's significantly worse going from effectively free money to sort of that percent. So let's have a look at the next bit, and I'll show you what I mean by here. So... I've decided to make this segment focus it mainly on US housing as opposed to UK because, you know, there are some weird idiosyncrasies of the British market. But, you know, this gives you an example. So I'm looking here at the cost to borrow money for a house. So a 30-year fixed rate mortgage in 2021. And the typical rate there was just under 3%. So fairly typical house, 400 grand. You could borrow that money over 30 years and you would end up paying on top of your 400 grand, you would pay back an extra 200 grand to bring the total cost of your loan over the 30 years, 600 grand. Okay. So fair enough. Mm-hmm. You can afford a house. Where that is today with rates for 30-year fixed at 7.7 is you borrow your 400, but instead of paying interest of 200 over the life, you pay back interest of 600. So that turns a $400,000 house into a $1 million house.
That is astonishing.
Yeah, it is a stupendous increase. And basically, you sort of, you know, you work it backwards, and what you get to is your cost of servicing the mortgage goes up from, in the top example, $1,600 a month to $2,800 a month.
I mean, that's like a different class. That's a different earnings.
Yes. Yes.
Category.
Well, I wanted to sort of break down to give examples to show you just how screwed this whole situation is. Apparently, the median wage in the US is $54,000.
Right.
Okay. So you take $54,000 and then you run it through, you know, a payroll calculator, assuming an average state because it matters where you are. But generally, if you're getting $3,700 in your pocket to spend every month out of your pay packet. That's before you bought anything. You've basically only been paid and you paid your taxes at this point. But you've got $3,700 to spend. So the difference here is between, in the top example, you were paying something like 43% of your take-home pay went on your mortgage, leaving you with, It was $2,100 for everything else. Mm. Well, now you're paying out 76% of your take-home pay, which leaves you with $900 for everything else.
For the whole month?
Yes.
That is just unbelievable.
Yeah, so utilities, any purchases, food, the lot.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you have to support a family. I mean, you cannot support a family on that, certainly.
Yes. So basically where I'm leading to with this is, what do you think is about to happen to US house prices? That's the question I've got, especially for our American viewers. What do you think is about to happen to your house prices, given this situation? There has been some modest tail off, but it is very modest at this point. I would suggest that there is probably something coming down the track on this one. Here's another data point. Let's look at this one. So this is an interesting tweet that a financial advisor put out. He said mortgage payments are now 58% more expensive than rent payments. Again, I ask the question, what do you think is about to happen to US house prices? Because you can basically get the same property, you can rent it for 58% cheaper than you can buy it.
Yeah. And then we have to wonder, well, who's gonna own all the houses then?
Yes, exactly. So you might think that I'm making the argument that renting is good.
Well,
let's have a look at the next one. Yep, so this is basically showing, for those of you listening, the growth of household incomes since the year 2000 and the increase in rents. Basically what it shows is that since the year 2000, your household income has gone up by about 77%. Sounds good, right? Rents have gone up 125%. Well, actually, over 125%.
That's really.
Yes. So either way, you're getting screwed. You're either losing ground by renting and basically having your the asset costs is sort of being pushed away from you, or you're mortgaged and you can't afford to eat or clothe yourself.
Yeah. I mean, on rent, I mean, it's an obvious observation to make, but actually, I made this case in an article I wrote a few weeks ago for Load Seekers, that we as conservatives, I think we should regard private property as being basically the most important sort of economic question. Putting private property in the hands of especially young people who want to start families.
Yes.
Because, you know, that's the foundation upon which you build a civilization.
Well, I mean, if you were a Conservative Party, for example, why would you not want as many young people as possible to own their own home and start a family?
Yeah. And obviously I have a vested interest in saying this because I'm a young person. But
but anybody who wants the nation to do well and not become a communist hellhole should also want that because you want young people bought into the system, not basically from the outside it trying to tear it down.
Yeah, we want skin in the game because skin in the game fosters sentimental attachment for one thing, which is very important, and it also means literally if things go to S, that's going to affect me in a very direct way.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I think it's crazy the housing situation now. I've given in a number of examples here of how I think the US system is sort of really tugging at this. These same pressures apply within the UK. The only thing is people are so emotionally attached to house prices in this country. So this happened before, back in 2008. In the US market, they saw a sort of a massive decline in house prices because the way they structure their mortgage is a little bit different. They tend to go for the long term, so you pay the cost up front. What happened in the UK back after 2008 is basically people just sat on their houses and just wouldn't sell because they could not bring themselves to lower the price. And so even though nobody was... So basically volume collapsed to almost nothing. Almost no houses were being sold. But people just could not bring themselves to accept less than their mental model of what their house was worth.
Yeah.
And so the housing market basically just died for several years until the government started printing money and then pumping the asset price back up, which is obviously what we actually need. We need we need significantly more houses to be built. And I will have a Brokenomics on that I'm brewing up at the moment. I'm going to get in a people who really know about the construction industry to explain why that's like it is. But actually, I'm reminded of another Brokenomics, which I'm in the process of writing at the moment, which is on Soviet economics. And basically what that's about is how effectively serfdom, what it does is an extractive economy that basically sucks as much as possible from the broadest number of people possible and then just funnels it all straight to the top. You know, that is basically what's happening. So look, I'll throw in a plug for my Brokenomics while I'm here. We got that. So this was a recent discussion that I had with Peter St. Onge. You might have seen cropping up on Twitter. He does some great stuff. So I had a good chat with him about all of this stuff. So it's worth checking out. So if you want to know about, all of this stuff that's going on, go and watch the Brokenomics series because it will explain in detail why this is going on here. So look, the system is breaking, and while I'm mostly talking about houses here, it applies to the UK as well. It applies to commercial real estate. It applies to government debt. You know, the whole system, as I've shown here in a few charts, is just becoming undone. It's completely unsustainable, which is why I found the next tweet quite interesting. So this is a guy called Balaji, who's a sort of tech guy and investor in the US. He recently sort of came to a lot of people's attention because he basically burnt $1 million promoting Bitcoin. What he did is he said, I think Bitcoin's going to reach a certain price, and it was I think he said Bitcoin will reach $1 million in a month or something, which was a bit unachievable, and I think he knew that. But basically what he was doing is he was getting people talking about it. And here he is highlighting, and I'll just replicate what he says here. You know, when the heads of the Bank for International Settlements says central banks will have absolute control over use of money, that's not democracy. That's when Keynesianism finally drops the mask and becomes flat out communism. Total centralization of control and all resources by unelected bureaucrats. So just bear in mind what I said a moment ago about the Soviet economy was essentially an extractive one where all of the money, all of the value was sucked up to the top, and total control was placed over the serfs. This guy, he's basically the final boss of the globalists. I know a lot of people and I know a lot of people talk about Klaus Schwab, but this guy is higher up on the chain of him. I don't think that he is the final boss. I think the real people pulling the strings, you don't get to see them. They are a small selection of actors that are tricky to go into. Let's listen to what this guy has to say, and you hear how chilling this is. Oh no! Can we play the video, John? So before we go into that, can we play the video from the tweet?
That is very dark.
Yes,
I mean, I don't want to be too low and too base. But if you look at that chap, I mean, he's literally like almost the stereotype of the fat cat.
Yes, it's the toad from Danger Mouse, isn't it?
Yeah,
I don't know if you remember that one, but yeah, I mean, there he is talking about the fact that, you know, at the moment people can use cash to make payments between them, and the central bank can't control it.
Yeah,
they want a system where they can control absolutely everything, and the key point at the end. They can regulate it, control it. So they don't want you making purchases to certain places.
Yeah.
Or they do want you spending your money in a way. They can just basically go in and edit it for you. They can make purchases for you. They can take your taxes from you. They can block you from doing certain things. And a system this broken, falling apart this fast, where does this go? Well, they're very clear on where it goes next, which is total digital control, total communism. Digital communism.
I mean, for your money, as an economist, do you think that CBDCs are basically inevitable at this point?
If they can get away with it, yeah. I mean, it is too attractive not to try.
It's the golden ticket, isn't it? It's the prize of all of this. Their ideology, the way they think, the kind of the rationalism, the managerialism, all roads lead to CBDCs.
But it's a bit like the first segment. If they get their total control. If they get their way, they will have us all living in monitored smart cities where we have to interact with the government all times through an app to report on our progress and what we're doing and where we are, and we'll be using a central bank. So there's no question they want that. The question is will we let them get away with it? Which is why I do what I do. It's because I don't want people to let them get away with it, and I want people to push back against this stuff, which you know, hopefully we're going to do.
Absolutely.
Right, so should we go into the comments? I think we've got some lovely video comments coming up. Sophie has sent us some art projects. Of some puppets listening to us, which is very sensible. The puppet is bowing and waving.
You should get in touch with the exhibition guys, because I'm sure they'd love to have your stuff at the next one. That's the other thing, you know, for any artists out there, you should get in touch with Pharaoh or Alexander Adams or any of the other guys.
Yes, well, they're very approachable, aren't they?
Yeah, well, they are, and they're very keen to have, you know, more artists, bigger, better, and so on. So,
well, there you go, Sophie. Get in touch with Alex.
Yes. There's a surprise.
Is it ended, General? Audio went. Yeah, I mean, California, it's just collapsing head over heels, isn't it?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
It's tumbling. I mean, I know that guy describes himself as a Californian refugee, so hopefully he's already got out.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Right, so let's have a look at the written comments. So, Ron Swanson says, Dan, can you shout out the P.O. box again? I want to send you a CD of my band's album. Oh, fantastic. CDs. I remember those. So, yes, you can. Indeed, the P.O. box address is Lotus Eaters, P.O. Box 4354, Swindon, SN39FX. So, thank you in advance for the CD. You could also, I suppose, send us a Google Drive link or something like that.
But, physical media is nice, though.
Yes, I just don't know if I've got a CD player. Or have it in the car. Yes. Mm. Yes. Yes, so I can listen to it. That's brilliant. Right, so Baron von Warhawk says, I must admit, I never expected the Dutch of all people to have their own version of Tiananmen Square. But then again, socialist-leaning governments tend to be quite fond of killing their own citizens. Yes.
True.
Yes, it always gets there, doesn't it? Mm. Sophie, with the puppets, she says, just a reminder, one of the biggest wheat exporters in all of Europe is Ukraine. And they are not exporting a lot these days because of war. Yeah. And the Netherlands, of course, the biggest European agriculture exporter. And they are globally second only to the US by emergency food, folks. Yes. Yes. So this is the problem. So I think Russia and Ukraine collectively are by far the biggest exporters of wheat and fertilizer. Mm. That fertilizer isn't going out either. So that means all the third world crop yields are going to be significantly down because fertilizer is still being produced, but it's just being bought up by all the rich countries instead. So, you know, Germany and, you know, France and UK, we're going to be okay. We're going to get the fertilizer that we need. We're just going to end up paying up for it because farmers are going to get screwed all over again. But the third world countries, they're going to see their crop yields plummet. And typically what you tend to see in these countries is they run their population right up to the maximum of a good year. And then when the yields drop off, all of a sudden they can't feed people. And then that tends to lead people turning up in boats and ending up in hotels in Swindon.
Yeah, or indeed South West Wales, where I was the other week. Tiny little town where they're having, this is Llanelli, I think is how you pronounce it. Yes. Several hundred of those types being put in a hotel in their town. Voice of Wales are doing some really good coverage of that, so I'd encourage viewers to go check that out. But you know, it's just all of this stuff coming together at once, isn't it? It's the money, it's the food. You know, all of this stuff is just collapsing beneath us. And you know, sure, it's only a a Voice of Wales are on tomorrow, I'm told. So
brilliant, okay,
that. Excellent. All of this stuff is all sort of collapsing in at the same time. So
you almost sort of wonder if it's planned or they're just spontaneously this incompetent and evil at the same time.
I tend to think of it as some combination of the two.
Yes.
You know, I refuse to believe that it's all planned, but I also refuse to believe that it's all just some crazy coincidence.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, a good blend sounds about right.
Yeah.
Right, so Jan says, if you scroll down on the document on the Smart Cities EU, you will find a list of cities in associated countries which include the EU, the UK, and the cities of Bristol and Glasgow. Yes, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Mr. Hill says, God bless those Dutch farmers. Yeah,
I do just want to say, on the Dutch farmers and, you know, the whole sort of attack on the agriculture industry that we're seeing, I think there's a certain amount of symbolism that we should take from that. And because I think of farming as a profession being sort of one of the more, if you want, sort of traditional professions you can have.
Yes,
you know, it's
basic.
But it's very, very attached to, I mean, you're working with your hands all
people
day,
and place,
right?
And
it's you're attached to the land itself.
Yes.
And you know, I don't think, you know, if you read Rudyard Kipling's poem The Land, for example, you know, I think that sense really comes through where they're, you know, this attachment to the land, it turns some, you know, it makes you, again, it's a sentimental attachment to the place you're in.
Yeah.
And the people that are opposing the Dutch farmers and who are, you know, the kind of bureaucrats that we're talking about, they hate that kind of sentimental attachment.
Well, they don't understand, I mean, food. I mean, they just think, okay, well, what does it matter if you close down the farms? Mm. You get your food from the shops. So it's
yeah.
Is how these people work. But yeah, no. And I really like the that Jeremy Clarkson series where he goes out.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, Clarkson's fun. Yeah, it's really good.
And he says, you know, this is the most fulfilled he's ever been.
Yeah. And the other thing is, if you look at the people that he's surrounded by in that show, very, you know, I forget the guy's name. He's the guy who sort of helps him out with everything. Yeah. Something like, at the time of the filming of the show, had never been to London. You know, somebody who was just very, very attached to the place he was in.
Yeah.
And I think there's something really beautiful about
that. I bet you could dig up a 9,000-year-old body on the bit of land and then DNA test Callum.
Yeah.
And you would find Caleb, and then you would find that there's like a direct sort of...
Yeah, they'd look exactly the same.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, I can believe... I mean, it probably helps in Clarkson's case that he went into it rich, so he doesn't have the pressures that a normal farmer would
have. That's definitely true. Yeah.
But I can well believe it is one of the most rewarding, satisfying jobs you can do.
Yeah.
Right. Sophie says, as we all know, it takes a man to be a real woman. Well, we can say that the tranny was ranked now because we're not on YouTube anymore. So, yes, we're free on that. Oh, we got a Dutchman. Right. So, Jerome Van Clackeran says, Dutchman here. The left doesn't burn down anything, but the police are way more mild with them. Mm. Luckily, the government has fallen and the Prime Minister is not running again, so there's a small hope of change if they don't fortify the elections. It all comes down to that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Whether they fortify those elections or not. I mean,
indeed.
Yeah. X, Y, and Z says, on paper, smart cities are a good idea. Imagine going to the city and your GPS could take you to an available car space near your destination just as it opens up. No more wasting time and fuel. But the globalist overlords just have to be arseholes and duck it up. Yeah, but you know it's going to be a mechanism of control and basically clamping down. Well, another thing I saw recently was it the EU or someone like that? They were basically saying to Twitter, you must remove people who speak out against us or we will shut you down.
Doesn't surprise me.
So it's just total regime control at every level to make sure that people can't question any of this.
Well, that's the thing. I think something that there's a tendency, certainly among the right, to just almost go full Luddite because these technologies are being used by, in Schmittian terms, our enemies at the moment. But I think it's really important to remember, as this commenter points out, that actually technology is not a bad thing in and of itself. Technology is just a tool. It's just whose hands it's in.
Yeah.
And right now it's in the hands of people who hate you, hate us. And
I'm actually in the process of starting to write a speech on this that I'm hoping to give later in the year, which basically makes this point, which is we can't retreat on this stuff. Mm. It's related to entropy. You know, we've got to keep moving through the system. Mm. We've got to adopt things when they come up. So one of the things that the right did very, very well early on was it embraced all this stuff, which is podcasting and the video content. And we absolutely dominated this until the thumb was firmly pressed down on the scale. Yeah. You know, the Young Turks got given millions from YouTube in order to build up a studio and do all of their stuff, and then we started getting censored and stuff. But the point is, we embraced it first and we dominated it. I think it has to be more of that. We need to sort of lead into it, and hopefully the next round of technologies, things like Web3, will allow us to be to not be so censorable as we have been. You're right. I think we need to move forward. Let's do a couple more from this segment before we move on. So Mr. Butcher says, see, this is one reason why I'm not fully on board with proportional representation. I really don't see a huge difference whatever way the elites will often close ranks to keep the commoners out. Well, yeah, I mean, hopefully that's not going to be the case in Holland, but I suppose we wait and see what happens with the elections there.
I do wonder how the BBB will be contained.
Well, there are definitely people working on it, aren't there? People
in
the back room thinking. Normally the way they contain them is somebody like Rudd would have gone to them and said, I'll tell you what, why don't we form a coalition with you? And then you'll get ministerial cars and you'll get salaries and all the rest of it. And you basically entice them in with money. That's normally how the system does it.
Yeah. And I must admit, I mean, you know, as much as that is a victory and as much as it's heartening to see, the leader is like a journalist, right, of that party?
Yeah,
I seem to recall not actually one of the farmers, which that rings alarm bells in my head, frankly.
Yeah, I don't know what her background is. Maybe she grew up on a farm. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know, but I just think it's worth mentioning.
Going on past experience, they will be bought in and paid off somehow.
Yeah,
but you know,
we can only hope they have the fortitude to resist that sort of thing.
Miss Rat says, I don't know about the UK, but in the US already has distributed police resources based on statistical analysis. Then the SJW started complaining about primarily minority neighbourhoods being over-policed, skewing the statistics. Good luck with that one. Yeah, so that has actually been the big pushback to the smart cities, is that if you take the benefits, it kind of leads you back to where policing was 10, 15 years ago.
Sure.
And they really don't like that.
No.
And Sophie pops in one more time to say, we are facing the same energy crisis. Let's build smart cities that run on energy. Yep. Again, basing everything on Ethernet connections and technology seems to be a flaw ingrained into it. Yes, that's fair. Do you want to do your section?
Yeah, yeah. So we've got Ross Diggle says, that's the problem with modern art. It's about preaching to elites and their propaganda, not about inspiring the soul and thoughts of the viewer. Art needs to call out to people who aren't just art critics. I agree. Yeah, no, I definitely agree.
Well, that's why I liked it, because I looked at that stuff and thought, yeah, I'd quite like some of those without knowing anything about art.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, you know, because it wasn't, fundamentally, it was not a political message that was there. Obviously, the art had a message because it's art. But the art was first and foremost, the message was first and foremost spiritual, I think, instead of merely political.
Yes. But it speaks to people who happen to be right wing.
Yes. Well, and yeah. Yeah. Mm. But that's because we are the only people who do have actually any sort of, I would argue, any kind of spiritual sense.
Yes.
In that way.
Yeah.
So Sophie Liv says, people are honestly hungry for good art, just things that are objectively good and you can enjoy the beauty of without having to understand it. Well, that's true, and that's the other thing. You know, if you go to somewhere like the Tate Modern, there are pieces in there that are actively and intentionally ugly and horrible to look at. I think to an extent there is a place for that, but in somewhere like the Tate Modern, there's a sense that the artist is doing it to humiliate you as the observer, whereas, you know, the stuff at the exhibition was aesthetically, or just on a purely aesthetic level, fantastic, of fantastic quality.
Yeah, the only art piece that I've saw, the only modern art piece that I've ever seen that I thought was connected to me in some way, although it was really dark actually, it was a Japanese artist, and what he did is he built this robot.
Yeah, I know the one you're talking about. Yeah,
I'll describe it. He built this robot, and basically it had a whole load of hydraulic fluid in it that leaks out constantly, and it needs to keep using this scraper thing to pull
like
the hydraulic fluid back into itself to keep itself alive. And early on, you know, it had lots of energy and it was waving to the crowd and it was doing stuff like that.
I think it had like voice lines that it would do as well.
Yeah. And he was quite enthusiastic, and now it's been running for like 5 or 6 years and it's struggling to get just the minimum of hydraulic fluid back into it, and it's wearing down and it's desperately trying to survive.
Yeah.
And it's gonna die. And it's like, that's a bit dark.
It is dark. I like that though.
Yeah.
It's I think it's quite a good piece. It's very inventive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was clever, but I don't think I'd clear out the living room to
put that in. Indeed. Yeah. Stanley West says, what an astonishing moment when even artists get tired of so-called activism. What a win for humanity overall. Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, artists, yeah, they can have their causes and they can have their, you know, they should have their cause and they should have their beliefs. But when the art itself is literally just a thinly veiled political, you know, propaganda attempt, whereas it's not art at that point anymore, right? It's just an exercise in politics.
Yeah.
Maria Manzi says, the Tate Modern and the art that is displayed is not totally without merits. Each piece has to be judged on its individual merits. I rather like the Tate Modern as much as the Tate. Sadly, the communist political vanguard has also captured both of these institutions, much like our museums. That's right. Yeah, no, I mean, Alexander Adams' Artivism talks a lot about the capture of the museums by these forces. I'm not going to sit here and say, because again, I'm not an art critic at all. I'm not going to sit here and say that everything in the Tate Modern is rubbish, because that's probably not the case, because there will be people who work very hard on their art and it's probably very good. I'm just saying, as a symbol and as a kind of, you know, the general feeling of the place is very much that it is a house of propaganda.
Yes.
JJHW says, modern art is just a money laundering operation. And I think there's probably certainly an amount of truth to that.
Yeah, it's probably often true, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I believe Hunter Biden might be an example of this. You know, had his art valued.
Yes, not only is he an enormously successful energy executive, he's also an artist.
Yeah, one of the foremost artists of our time, Hunter Biden. I don't
Extraordinary.
Know. Yeah.
Oh, look, there it is.
Oh, yeah,
John
found the one.
It. Yeah, yeah. Let's play this. Yeah, so there it is, just... So this is, I think it's towards the end of its life now. It's basically just, let's leave the audio on.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that was
this looks like towards the start of its life. Cause it's quite.
Yeah, because it's being quite expressive.
Yeah.
at this stage. So yeah, we got that robot that I was talking about, if you're listening. But yeah, frolicking around, waving to the crowd,
yeah,
being very graceful, and so on. And then I think if you see it later on, it is really struggling to survive. Yeah. I think this is all from
2019.
Yeah.
There you go. So yeah. That's it, bringing in the fluid.
Bringing in the hydraulic fluid to try and survive, and where it is now is it's really struggling. Yep.
Yeah. So Desert Rat says, the Tate Modern Museum is a post-apocalyptic industrial complex. Good to know. Yeah, that about sums it up, I would say.
Oh, right. So let's do a couple from round out with the house prices. So, Andrew Narrow, as a recent home buyer, I can confirm the housing market is definitely screwed. So much worse off since before the times pre 2021. Still better to own than rent. I appreciate all your work, Dan, and as so many have said, you make economics understandable. Wonderful having Charlie Downs on as well. Would love to have him on again soon. Well, hopefully that will be the case.
Yeah, yes, that's very kind. Thank you.
Absolutely. So, thank you for all your compliments there. And everyone, and congratulations for becoming a house owner as well. Mm. So, be careful of that leverage, but it's nothing like having your own. Stanley West says, this is actually my current dissertation. Oh, good. Mm. The government underplay the importance of macroeconomic stability at all times. It is crazy to think they are sane and clear-headed. Inflation, budget deficit, current account deficit, and unemployment are through the roof because of stupid government policies in COVID time. Yeah, absolutely. So when you finish that dissertation, feel free to pick a copy over to me, and I'll have a read of that.
And I hope it gets marked as well.
yes, hopefully it does. Mm. I don't know if he's sent it in for marking or whether he's just starting it or something. I don't know how that works. They just have no regard for stability. It's just whatever suits them that week.
Yeah.
To get them out of a political hole, because they run the economy on a political time scale, which is basically a few weeks to months.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I'm sure that's not helped by the short-termism that democracy encourages anyway.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even if they were being for themselves long-term, that would mean 4 years.
Yeah.
Whereas an economic cycle is like 8 to 12.
Yeah.
So it's no wonder the bloody thing doesn't work. Mm. Wuhan Wet Market says... American house buyer here. Where I live, you can get a 3-bed, 2-bath house for a little over $115,000. Really?
Must be nice.
Where the hell do you live? Not a new house, but a decent one. Probably a couple of problems. And built in the 1950s or 70s. For reference, this is southeastern New Mexico. Oh, and West Texas Panhandle. Okay, that's interesting. Hmm. But I know the Americans, they use a lot more wooden construction, so I don't know whether 50s and 70s holds up as well, because I know houses built in the UK basically last forever because they're sort of brick all the way through, and I know the Americans use a lot more wood, but I mean, presumably the 50s and 70s houses are still good, but interesting. Okay, so Yankee Doodle Demon says, Dan, the current US house market is reminiscent of the late 70s. Interest rates 13%. When the devastating Community Reinvestment Act of 1977 came into existence. That same fetid legislation was the first signpost of the 2008 crisis. As a current homeowner, if I had to move my house, choices are significantly reduced in the current market. What a stark contrast from 5 years ago. Yeah, so this is the thing. Because the Americans, they do their 30-year mortgages.
Yeah.
If you then get a much better job offer, but, you know, it involves moving halfway across the country or like that...
Mm.
You're not going to give up a 30-year fixed at below 3% for something at 7.7% unless you are getting an absolute monster pay rise.
Yeah, you'd have to be doing pretty well.
You're absolutely certain that you're not going to lose that job, because the last thing you want to do is move over there, lose your previous deal, get a new job, and sometimes this does happen. Then you get fired, or you don't get through your probation, or however they do it in the US, and then you're suddenly faced with this and you just absolutely destroyed it at that point. So that's going to lower labour mobility, which is going to, again, add friction to the economy, which is going to make it harder for them to come out the other side of this.
Yeah.
Mr. Silver says, I recall when it was the best numbers of our lives under Trump. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, he did run up debt as well, but he was nowhere near as utterly incompetent as is going on. And while the government spending wasn't being brought down fast enough, they were at least generating more wealth to help pay it off. Under Biden, there's both less wealth and more spending. Yeah, so I'm not going to be too kind about Trump when it comes to economics, because a degree of it was a bit of hype and money printing, but I mean it was leagues and leagues better than what Biden is doing. So so Trump should have been a lot more aggressive on bringing down spending, which he kind of let. So he let it rise, but not as much as perhaps it could have risen. But yeah, the Biden is just spectacular.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, it's probably like trying to stop a tidal wave, with just your hands, isn't it? Who knows how much credit we want.
Yeah, very
he probably did the best he could.
Yeah, very difficult to do in a democracy, bring this stuff down. Mm. Right, we've got Miss Desert Rat says, the housing bubble burst, causing more people to go upside down on their home loans, meaning the value of homes will fall lower than what is owed on the loan. Yeah, and when you start getting the forced sellers, then the housing market will really start to tip on this one. Blah, blah, blah. Also from Miss Rat says, I truly believe the next depression in the US will occur as a slow slump caused by the government and private debt. I'm appalled about the amount of debt people are taking on. Yeah, and the government on your behalf as well. I mean, the government debt per taxpayer, I think, is $250,000. Right. So if you're a US taxpayer, you're automatically in debt of $250,000, just because that's your share of what the government debt is. And that's not including all those other liabilities that I mentioned.
Mm.
You misspoke, Dan. London isn't on fire yet. Bring enough boat people over and perhaps that may change. Until then, I guess Londoners can enjoy the knife crime. Yeah, did you see that tweet from Sadiq Khan yesterday about knife crime?
No, I must have missed that. So, I saw his one saying that London was built on immigration, which is
So what Sadiq Khan said is that you can't arrest your way out of a crime problem. We need to deal
with... Sorry, what is the solution then?
He said we need to deal with the knives. So it's not arresting the criminals. That doesn't help. You need to go after the cutlery.
Well, that's literally the same argument as, mass shootings are caused by guns.
Yes.
Right? It's the same argument, but it's even more absurd with knives.
Yes.
And that's insane. Do you ever see the kitchen knife just sitting on the side there and think, ooh, I might go out on the stab tonight?
The comparison that I gave was El Salvador. You've probably seen how El Salvador has behaved. So El Salvador's built these mega prisons. They've arrested thousands and thousands of gang members. They haven't gone out and arrested knives and guns.
No.
They've gone out and arrested the crime.
People.
Yes, people.
Perpetrators.
Yes, and now crime has plummeted and Bukele has a 90% approval rating.
Very good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very, very sensible. Mr. Power says, referring to last week, you could have just said the Americans have a spending problem and therefore independence from Great Britain has been rescinded. Actually, when you put it like that, I wouldn't really want to get them back if they brought the debt with them.
Yeah, do you want to inherit those problems?
Yeah, that's a bit like marrying a woman who's in a lot of debt. You wouldn't want to do that. But it's not like the realm is doing any better as far as being fiduciarily responsible. Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I spent some time working in India and all the guys there were saying, we want to be run by the British again.
Yeah.
Because their government was so corrupt. And it's like, well, yeah, but you're imagining the government that we had in like the 1850s.
Several hundred years ago, yeah.
Yeah. I wish we had them as well.
As do I.
But we don't.
Yeah.
Right. Honourable mentions. O-Punk says, ask them about their favourite artists. Oh, Johnny Cash. So that's easy. What's your favourite artist?
Musicians.
Well, he just said artists, and I don't know about art.
So. Yeah. I really like Oasis and Kaiser Chiefs. A few years back, I was really into... Like, MF Doom used to be my favourite. Are you familiar with him?
No.
Hip-hop artist.
No.
I'm not so into hip-hop anymore.
Right.
But yeah, MF Doom is still up there because he's excellent. Those would be
my top
three.
Have a favourite art artist?
Pharaoh.
Yeah, I'll go with that one. Yep.
Yeah.
Sophie says, dudes, love the new beauty standards. Now I'm in easy 10. I don't have to do anything. I'm worthy of Miss Universe. It's great. Give me my crown. Yes, well. Oh, no, actually, we're not on YouTube, so I can say yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Being a woman is, the right start. Somebody says, Thomas, something. Dan, are you buying silver at the moment? Well, I spent 20 years as a gold bug. So I may have accumulated a little bit of gold and silver, but I did lose most of it in a boating accident, Mr. Taxman. So so that's unfortunate. But yeah, I am a big fan.
That's
a
terrible shame, that.
Yeah, but at the moment, I also like Bitcoin, obviously, because it's another thing that you can have and the government can't take from you.
Sure.
Unless you give them your private key. Somebody says, well, this has been heavily redacted, I still want a history of the WEF. Yes. Yes, I should do that as a broken. Yes, I should do that as a brokenomics, because it is quite interesting actually. Because basically, Klaus Schwab. Mm. So he's this middle-ranked, 32-year-old economics professor, and then he starts a forum to talk about economics, and the following year, world leaders start turning up.
Weird.
Yeah. And you got to think, is that really organic? Mm. Or is there something else behind that?
Yeah. It's very interesting. I don't know anything about this, so that'd be really interesting.
Well, I don't actually know the answer. Mm. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So I could speculate, but I'd get in trouble. Right. Lady 50 says, who does Dan recommend not buying gold from? Oh, actually, stay paying attention, and we might have some gold recommendations coming up in the not-too-distant future. And Dom replies, get them to guess who the guilty nonce is. Oh, yes. Well, that's going to get us sued, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
I don't know who it is.
It could be any of them.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, and I wouldn't probably be that surprised.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Somebody says, Dan covered the US housing market, but what does he predict the UK house market is, as we do have a shortage of stock? Do you think we're going to crash? Yeah, that's what I sort of mentioned about the stuff about the UK market is weak, because basically people just don't sell, and like you say we have got a shortage of supply, so that could be an issue. And I think we are starting to run out, so I will basically wrap it up there and say thank you very much. Thank you, Charlie, for coming on.
Cheers, Dan.
And cheerio, people. See you next time.
You can find me at cfdowns_ on Twitter, and my website is cfdowns.uk, where you can find all of my work.
Good.